Thank you all for being here. I've done a number of signings since the book came out in February, and none have been as well attended. If I had only known, I would have been catering all of them. really, I had no idea. Everybody's a sports writer at heart, I guess, wants the food. I wanted to take just a few minutes. I don't know what the protocol is normally here at the Aspen Institute, but I wanted to do a brief reading from a chapter midway through the book. The book, as Liz said, is Triumph. It's about Jesse Owens. It is not by any means a full-scale biography. What I've attempted to do is tell Jesse Owens' story, the story of his life up through the 1936 Olympics, the games of the 11th Olympiad in Berlin, an event which he dominated, Olympics that he dominated to an extent which no one had ever previously or subsequently dominated Olympic games. And my previous book was called Cinderella Man. It was about the fighter Jim Braddock and about another fighter named Max Baer and kind of the collision course they were on to fight for the world championship in 1935. And the backdrop of that story is clearly the Great Depression. This story is taking place at exactly the same time, but the focus is not on the Great Depression. It didn't affect Jesse Owens the same way it affected the fighter Jim Braddock, who at that time had three kids. Jesse did have a kid, but he was a full-time student. He was younger. Really, this is almost a three-part story about Owens himself, about the remarkable performance that he fashioned in Berlin, which I would argue with anyone is the greatest athletic achievement ever, but made much more significant by the political circumstances of the undertaking. Performing in Hitler's Germany at the time of an ascendant Third Reich, at a time when in the United States he was legally a second-class citizen himself, Jesse Owens. And so the story is, it's about Jesse, it's about the meaning of hosting the games and the Winter Games in 1936 in Garmisch-Partenkirchen in the Bavarian Alps, the significance of that for the Third Reich, what it was trying to achieve as the host of the games. And it's also about another element of the story which I feel has largely been forgotten, the boycott movement in the United States, which nearly succeeded. There was a vote in 1935 of the Amateur Athletic Union, which decided such matters as to whether the United States would participate in the Winter and Summer Games in Germany in 1936. And I think the exact totals, there were about 111 delegates, and the measure to boycott the games was defeated by 3.5 votes. There were half votes for emeritus members, et cetera. And that's something I don't think most people realize, that there was such a strong boycott movement and how close it came to succeeding. And Jesse Owens' role in the boycott debate I discuss as well. And those are how the stories kind of intertwine. And I think for the bulk of the talk, I'd really like to discuss Jesse Owens and why I think his achievement is so significant and all of the pressures he was under. But to give you a sense of the backdrop, I'd like to read to you a chapter called The Battle Tent of Some Great Emperor, which is about the days leading up to the opening ceremony in Berlin in August 1936, July and August 1936. So if you'll allow me. As Jesse Owens and his teammates were still at sea, the Third Reich was rolling out its red and black carpet for international celebrities, including America's most famous citizen, Charles Lindbergh. Visits such as those Lindbergh made were the raison d'etre of the Berlin Games. As much as it meant to the Germans to prove that they were athletically capable, it meant much more to them to show off their new society, minus, of course, its uglier idiosyncrasies. It had been 9 years since Lucky Lindy had touched down at Le Bourget outside Paris in the Spirit of St. Louis, completing the first solo flight across the Atlantic Ocean. It's difficult now to appreciate the magnitude of his achievement and his subsequent deification. He was handsome, wholesome, and heroic. He was celebrated in poetry and song. In the words of William L. Shirer, Lindbergh was, quote, the idol of the nation, its most publicized citizen, its one authentic hero. Shirer had covered Lindbergh's landing at Le Bourget and had followed with the rest of the world the trajectory of his life and career. He read with horror of the kidnapping and murder of Lindbergh's infant son. He reacted with a different kind of horror when he learned that Lindbergh and his wife, Anne Morrow, had moved in 1935 to an island off the coast of Brittany to be near the island's best-known resident, Dr. Alexis Carrel, a French-American Nobel laureate in medicine with an affinity for fascism. Carrel, incidentally, was the first surgeon and one of only three ever to win the Nobel Prize for Medicine. In Berlin, Lindbergh declined to meet formally with American reporters. He'd grown extremely wary of the press, choosing instead to spend most of his time in the company of his fellow aviator, Hermann Göring, the fat chief of the rapidly growing German Air Force, as Shirer described him. Göring and Lindbergh spent a pleasant afternoon switching off the controls of the Field Marshal von Hindenburg, not the famous blimp, but an enormous eight-engine plane built by Lufthansa. Lindbergh did make a speech decrying the development of bombers that he predicted might soon lay waste to all of Europe. But when Shirer and a few other American correspondents based in Berlin heard that he had been won over by Göring, Goebbels, and their ilk, they cornered him at one of Goebbels' parties and tried to disabuse him of his impressions, to no avail. Lindbergh proceeded to tell us what the situation was in Germany, Shirer wrote, and to express his admiration for what had been achieved here. He, too, had found a happy, united people, he said. As an airman, he was particularly impressed by the German Air Force and the progress of German aviation in general. Once again, we did not get a word in. Like most reporters who had been stationed in Germany during the Nazis' rise to power, Shirer found the Third Reich utterly contemptible. But the Nazi propagandists were talented, and in an uncertain world, Charles Lindbergh was far from the only foreigner to fall under their sway. Still, there were those capable of seeing the regime for what it truly was. One of the more skeptical visitors to Berlin as the Olympics were about to commence was a 35-year-old writer from Asheville, North Carolina. He was a drunk and a bigot, but neither of these qualities hindered his career as a novelist. In fact, by the time tuberculosis killed him at the age of 37, he had achieved a measure of fame so profound that nearly 70 years later, his novels are still widely read and admired. Thomas Wolfe went to Berlin to cover the games and to see for himself what Hitler was up to. He was also taking notes for a novel that would become You Can't Go Home Again, which was published posthumously in 1940. In it, George Weber, Wolfe's alter ego, flits from New York to Paris to Berlin at the time of the Olympics. Like Wolfe, George Weber is both awed and terrified by Hitler's capital. Perhaps more than any other American who attended the games, Wolfe was able to communicate the prevailing mood. George observed that the organizing genius of the German people, which has been used so often to such noble purpose, was now more thrillingly displayed than he'd ever seen it before. The sheer pageantry of the occasion was overwhelming, so much so that he began to feel oppressed by it. There seemed to be something ominous about it. One sensed a stupendous concentration of effort, a tremendous drawing together and ordering in the vast collective power of the whole land. And the thing that made it seem ominous was that it so evidently went beyond what the games themselves demanded. Although the Germans had packed their uniforms into closets and their anti-Semitic posters into warehouses, they could not hide what was in their hearts, and the thought of it made Wolfe shiver. It was clear that a great society was building its strength and flaunting its resourcefulness, and that there would be dire consequences for anything that stood in its way. To its Olympic visitors, Berlin was both sinister and majestic. Maybe it wasn't quite Vienna or Paris yet, but it seemed to be only a matter of time before it would match and then surpass all its rivals. Despite the official decrees mandating civility, the entire city was on an aggressive footing. Jutting out its chin, daring someone to take a shot. The populace, on the whole, was still enthralled with Nazism, especially after the events of March, when the Rhineland had been remilitarized and France had done nothing to counter that action. Hitler has got away with it, Shirer had marveled in his diary. Unrestrained enthusiasm floated through the city, which was decked out in festive Nazi banners. From one end of the city to the other, Wolf rode from the Lustgarten to the Brandenburger Tor along the whole broad street of Unter den Linden, through the vast avenues of the Fairy Tiergarten, and out through the western part of Berlin to the very portals of the stadium. The whole town was a thrilling pageantry of royal banners, not merely endless miles of looped-up bunting, but banners 50 feet in height, such as might have graced the battle tent of some great emperor. Wolf could not have known, few people did, that more than grime had been scrubbed from Berlin's streets in the days leading up to the games. On July 16th, in compliance with an order from the Interior Ministry, Berlin police had rounded up about 800 gypsies and deposited them in a filthy, verminous camp just outside the city in Marzahn. A week later, Richard Walter Dare, the Argentine-born German Minister of Food and Agriculture, issued a decree that was sent to local authorities throughout Germany to enforce. All anti-Semitic posters must be suppressed during the period in question. The fundamental attitude of the government does not change, but Jews will be treated as correctly as Aryans at this time. Houses on the main roads must be whitened and even repainted if possible. Street lighting must be improved. Streets and squares must be cleaned. Agricultural workers in the fields must not take their meals near the roads nor pass near the roads. Dare later made a name for himself in the field of eugenics. As the head of the SS Race and Resettlement Office, he wrote, "Just as we breed our Hanoverian horses using a few pure stallions and mares, so we will once again breed pure Nordic Germans." He was among the architects of what came to be known as the Final Solution, which led to his conviction at Nuremberg and a stunningly brief 5-year prison sentence. In the summer of 1936, though, Dare wanted the Third Reich to appear to be inclusive, at least for a few weeks. The Nazis declared a ceasefire against virtually all their traditional targets. No action against unruly Catholics and Protestants, Shira wrote. No savage attacks against the decadent Western democracies and Jewish-dominated America. All was, for the moment, sweetness and light, except for an occasional diatribe against the terrible Bolsheviks. Under Goebbels' direction, the Reich Press Chamber issued several decrees to domestic news outlets in the weeks leading up to the opening ceremony. Even as the Germans bowed to international pressure by allowing the fencing champion Helene Mayer to compete in the Games, Goebbels' office made it clear that her Jewishness, actually she was half Jewish, was a taboo topic. Back in February, the press chamber had announced that no comment should be made regarding Helene Mayer's non-Aryan ancestry or her expectations for a gold medal at the Olympics. On July 16th, just in case anyone had forgotten, the chamber decreed that press coverage should not mention that there are two non-Aryans among the women, Helene Mayer and Gretel Bergmann. Bergmann, however, was dropped from the German team just before the Games, despite the fact that she held the national record in the high jump. The Nazis' efforts to placate the international community were convincing only to those who wished to be convinced. Perhaps no one saw their true intentions more clearly than Fred Farrell of the Daily Worker. Of all the distinguished reporters and columnists who were writing about the Olympics as the opening ceremony approached, Farrell had the best sense of what was at stake, the prestige of the Third Reich. Frequently, the Daily Worker stories were tainted by the paper's insistence on seeing everything through the prism of its politics, but in the case of the 1936 Olympics, its prism was perfectly focused. In an impressive display of prescience, Farrell wrote, "I have an idea that these Olympic Games will have repercussions that will not help toward the amity of nations as they are supposed to do. There will be dark trouble clouds along the horizon. They may develop into thunderstorms that will make Eleanor Holm Jarrett's champagne party look like an afternoon tea for the kiddies." Eleanor Holm Jarrett was America's best female swimmer. She'd won a gold medal in the backstroke in 1932 and was the world record holder, but she was kicked off the team on the voyage over to Europe for getting drunk on several occasions. Not the kind of thing you would imagine happening today. I mean, getting kicked off the team. Then he anticipated, Farrell, the controversy that lingers even now. In the long run, he wrote, "I'm afraid that noblest sportsman of them all, Herr Hitler, will find the Olympic Games the bitterest disappointment. When the time comes to present medals to Negroes and Jews, his ideas of racial supremacy for the people he wants to be supreme will suffer something of a shock. Will he shake hands with Jesse Owens, for example? The Reichsfuhrer will be on the spot, but definitely. If he doesn't take Jesse's hand, he will be marked as a bad sportsman. If he does, how can he laugh it off to his stormtroopers who've been taught that Negroes and Jews have no place in the Hitler scheme of things?" For the most part, however, the German propaganda machine was successful at portraying the regime in the most favorable light. Still too weak to state his true intentions, Hitler was forced to pretend to want nothing more than peace and a place of honor for Germany in European affairs. He needed time, time to build strength, time to perfect his plans, time to fully rearm. And if he did not lull his neighbors into a false sense of at least partial security, he would not be afforded the time he so desperately needed. For Hitler and his colleagues, the Berlin Games were the ultimate opportunity not to promote their agenda, but to hide their agenda under a cloak of hospitality, prosperity, and efficiency. This is the most loathsome feature of the swastika crusade, Victor Klemperer, a 55-year-old Jewish-born history professor, wrote in his diary in Dresden. that it is conducted hypocritically and in secret. We are not conducting a crusade. We do not shed blood either. We are completely peaceable people and only want to be left in peace. And at the same time, not the smallest opportunity for propaganda is missed. 2 weeks before the opening ceremony, Paul Gallico arrived in Berlin. He was eager to get acclimated to the site of the Olympics, eager, too, to be as far as possible from Chicago, where his 21-year-old second wife, Elaine, was busy testifying against him in divorce proceedings. Gallico was among the leading sports columnists of the time. As she was accusing him of assault and lesser misdeeds, Gallico was walking the grounds of the sparkling athletes' village the Germans had so carefully planned and built. Gallico, who'd fought the Germans as a Navy gunner in World War I, was surprised to realize that his former enemies had situated the village, which was already housing the youth of the world who were gathering ostensibly to promote international understanding, next to an army shooting range. The juxtaposition was too delicious for him to ignore. "Your wandering correspondent," he wrote, "hopes he has not spoiled anything for the visiting firemen who will be arriving here shortly and who might find good copy in the fact that the anxious Germans are rehearsing for the next war right next door to where the athletes are flexing their muscles and practicing to win the great peace games of 1936. Unlike Gallico, though, most observers raved about the athletes' village despite its location on the outskirts of the vast capital. Beautifully landscaped and luxuriously appointed, the Germans' tidy brick athletic enclave put the bungalows of the Los Angeles Olympics to shame. It was staffed by dozens of bi- and multilingual volunteers, and the chefs in residence prepared high-quality food familiar to delegations from Japan to Peru. Athletes were encouraged to mingle with one another and with visitors in common areas. Open to the public, the village became a popular destination for tourists before and during the Olympic fortnight, a situation unimaginable after the massacre of Israeli athletes in Munich in 1972. The gifted black athletes from the U.S. who would soon occupy the village naturally were the chief topic for America's black press. As the opening ceremony neared, papers such as the Chicago Defender and the Amsterdam News all but dropped every other story they'd been covering. After all, 16 black men and 2 black women would represent the U.S. The American team in L.A. had included only 6 blacks. And in the wake of Joe Louis's knockout at the hands of Max Schmeling, Louis was a source of embarrassment, not pride. R. Walter Murgison of the Pittsburgh Courier, one of a handful of black reporters in Berlin, was typically breathless. Jesse Owens and his brown-skinned brothers of the United States are the men of the hour in this ancient capital of a mighty nation today as the zero hour for this 11th Olympiad approaches. On every tongue, the name of the fleet-footed sons and daughters of Ham are being bandied about. And this was in the black press. On July 24, 1936, the SS Manhattan docked at Bremerhaven on the North Sea. Within a few hours, Jesse Owens and his teammates, as well as his coach, Larry Snyder, were in Berlin marching in a parade down Unter den Linden. After an audience with the mayor, the Americans were taken to their quarters 15 miles away at the Olympic Village. They were greeted by members of the Hitler Youth. Snyder stayed behind at his hotel in Berlin, but Owens and Dave Albritton, his best friend, a high jumper, threw their suitcases on their beds and headed out to find the track where they would train. After 9 days aboard ship, Owens was eager to shake off his wobbly sea legs. "I feel great," he said to Albritton as they jogged down the cinder track at the edge of the village. "I don't think I could feel better." "Take it easy, Jesse," Albritton said, although usually Owens was telling him to take it easy. "Dave," Jesse said, "don't worry about me. I think this place suits me." Owens embraced everything about the village. Here in the heart of the Third Reich, he found a utopian athlete's paradise. He loved the food and the companionship, probably in that order. He wrote in his diary that he was eating steaks and plenty of it, as well as bacon, eggs, ham, fruit, and juices. And for a good time, he gravitated to the easygoing Australians. "What liars they are," he noted in his diary, admiringly. So that's, just want to give you a sense of where we were in the summer of 1936 in Berlin, and how Jesse got there. What makes, I think, Owens' story so remarkable and so significant is are his personal circumstances. He is a grandson of slaves. He is the son of a sharecropper. He doesn't get any formal schooling, really, until his family moves north from Alabama to Cleveland when he's 9 years old in 1922. He goes off to the Ohio State University in 1933 at a time when the campus is still segregated. he can't live with his white teammates there in Columbus. And he is 22 years old when he goes to Berlin, and there is so much pressure on him. He understands clearly that if he does not achieve what he's expected to achieve at the Olympics, that is to win 3 gold medals, or at least to win 1 or 2, that his opportunities are going to be extremely limited when he gets back home. He's not a good student. He's not book smart at all. In fact, Jesse never graduates from Ohio State, although to the university's credit, they give him every opportunity to do so. And although he was no longer competing as an athlete after the games, they continue to keep him on scholarship. But also to the university's credit, they didn't just pass him and let him graduate. So he has a young daughter. He has a wife. He has 9 brothers and sisters, none of them making very good livings at the depths of the Depression in Cleveland at this time. And he is going, he's never been outside the United States before, and he's going to this place thousands of miles away, which he has been told will be remarkably hostile to him because of the color of his skin, more hostile to him than even his native Alabama was, where official government policy regards him as something less than a human being, into a stadium where there were 110,000, mostly Germans, screaming, and he is literally under the gaze of Adolf Hitler. And yet, despite all these pressures and knowing how much was at stake, he doesn't just rise to the occasion. He does so in a way that no one has ever been able to match. He wins 4 gold medals, more than anyone had expected him to win. He does so each time in remarkable fashion with world records, some of them which only were not official because of prevailing winds and such. He wins over the entire capital. He's enormously popular. To his surprise, the first time he walks into the Olympic Stadium and there are 110,000 people there and hardly a black face in the crowd, he is cheered wildly. It turns out that his grace and his talent was irresistible even to the German masses. And this is all coming again at a time when in the United States, Major League Baseball is segregated, the National Football League is segregated, the National Hockey League is segregated. He could not compete as a collegiate athlete from representing Ohio State at any meets below the Mason-Dixon on the same field with whites. Yet he really doesn't harbor any bitterness. He understands his situation. He knows what he has to do. He doesn't see himself initially as someone who's there to make a political statement, which is what this story really becomes all about. He's there to do the best that he possibly can so that he can build a future for himself and his family. And it's remarkable in the way that he does it. And with each of his victories, there's a compelling story that goes along with it. Perhaps the best-known story is about the long jump competition. Jesse Owens was easily the best broad jumper, as it was called at the time, in the world. He held the world record, 26 feet, 8 1/4 inches, a record that would stand. He set it in 1935, and it would stand until 1959, so for 24 years. But he is struggling in the qualification process. Twice he fouls, and then before the last jump, and it's all he has to clear is a very, very easy distance for him, a distance he's been clearing since he was in high school, approximately 23 feet. And he knows he's down to his one last jump to qualify. He's fouled on his first two attempts, as I said. And at this point, the second best long jumper in the world, a German named Lutz Long, approaches him and says to him in his broken English, you know, there are various reports about exactly what was said, but something to the effect of, in his poor idiomatic English, Jesse Owens, what has got your goat? You should easily clear this distance. Why don't you just put a towel down a foot before the takeoff board so that there's no chance for you to foul? So Jesse, this would seem to be common sense, but Jesse always gave Lutz Long credit for this gesture of sportsmanship. And Owens then easily makes the distance, starting from behind the board, taking off from behind the board. And in this epic confrontation in the long jump final the same afternoon, Owens eventually bests Long as they go back and forth, breaking Olympic records. And Long, who is the epitome of the Aryan ideal, he's this tow-headed, sleek, beautifully proportioned young athlete from Leipzig. With Hitler standing there, obviously disappointed that Long has lost, Long grabs Jesse Owens out of the pit after Owens has made the winning jump and grabs him by the arm and parades around the entire stadium in full view of everyone, obviously. And it's that moment that I think, it sounds corny, but it really does, I think, capture what the Olympic Games are supposed to be about and too often are not about, the ability of the Games to bring together people from such disparate backgrounds and to strive well rather than to strive merely to win. And there are other stories like that about his feats at the Games, the most controversial of which is about his fourth gold medal, which came in the 4x100-meter relay, an event he was not expected to participate in. He ends up being named to the team the night before the competition. And to give you a little bit of background, the American track and field coaches, the official coaches, were Lawson Robertson, who was the head coach at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dean Cromwell, who was the head coach at the University of Southern California, which had built up a remarkable track program over the years, the most successful college track program in history to that point. And they've often been accused of anti-Semitism and bigotry. You know, the evidence, there's ample evidence to suggest that they were, in fact, bigots, but not remarkable bigots. Certainly they were far from special in their outlooks at the time. But what happened is the Olympic trials took place on Randall's Island in New York City in July, the month before the Olympics. And the plan was that the top finishers in the 100-meter sprint would compete in the individual event in Berlin. They happened to be Jesse Owens, another African-American named Ralph Metcalf, and a white sprinter who had raced at USC under Dean Cromwell named Frank Wyckoff. And then the guys who finished fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh would compose the 4x100-meter relay team. The guy who finished seventh, Mack Robinson, Jackie Robinson's older brother, was not really a 100-meter sprinter, though. So although he had finished he'd done well in the event, so instead they were going to make it the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth place finishers. And they were Frank Wyckoff, Foy Draper, and two Jewish sprinters named Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller. And they went to Berlin, Stoller and Glickman and Draper, planning to compete only in the 4x100-meter relay. And it was assumed for the most part that, as it had been stated in Randall's Island, that Frank Wyckoff would be the fourth man on the relay team. Well, I should say that Stoller and Glickman are the only two Jews on the U.S. track team, period. And obviously, it's a delicate situation because where the games are taking place, they have not had an opportunity to compete. The last day of the track and field competitions, the 4x100 meters, the U.S. has been utterly dominant in sprinting, thanks to Jesse Owens and to Ralph Metcalf. On the morning of the race, there are actually 2 days of races in the 4x100-meter relay. There are the preliminaries one day and the following day, the finals. At that time, though, you had to race in all the you couldn't freely substitute as you now can. So whoever ran in the first preliminary race would be the same team in the finals the next day. And on the morning of the race, Cromwell and Robertson announced that Sam Stoller and Marty Glickman were off the team, and that instead Ralph Metcalf and Jesse Owens would both be racing. And obviously this was a huge disappointment to Glickman and Stoller, who would have easily won a gold medal as part of a U.S. team that would have been impossible for anybody else to beat. Robertson said that he made the change because he wanted to put his best team out on the track, and he had heard reports that the Dutch and Germans had been hiding their best sprinters and were going to surprise the Americans in the 4x100-meter relay competition, which is absurd on its face. You can't have world-class sprinters who would challenge the likes of the American team and no one know who they are. You can't hide them, and there'd be no reason not to put them in the individual competition, which is much more prestigious than the relay competition. So that explanation didn't make any sense. His other rationale that he was just putting his best team out there on the track, that's more plausible. Certainly Ralph Metcalf and Jesse Owens were the two best American sprinters. However, there's a very good case to be made that Glickman and Stoller were both more talented than Foy Draper, who, like Frank Wyckoff, was a USC runner who had competed for Dean Cromwell. And it seems like so much minutia now, I'm sure, to many of you, but it's a controversy that's really lingered for 70 years about exactly what happened and what the motivations were. And one of the things that my book explores, which had not been previously explored, period, certainly not since actually the days of the games, never been written about in a book, I should say that the story that's been passed down for the last 70 years mostly was that Jesse Owens stood up in the meeting where it was announced that he and Metcalf would be running and said, "Coach, I've got my 3 gold medals. You should let Marty and Sam run." That's the story that Marty Glickman, who would become a legendary broadcaster and a hero of mine and really a wonderful guy, on a side note, that's the story that Marty always told. It wasn't told the same way by other people in the meeting. Ralph Metcalf, for instance, who would become a 4-term United States congressman, not that that's any indication that we should believe what he says, he said that Jesse didn't say a word in the meeting. And Jesse himself said that he remembers getting up and saying, "I've got my 3 gold medals, let Sam run," which makes more sense to me because if you're saying let Sam and Marty run, he's also volunteering Ralph Metcalf's spot. And Ralph Metcalf, to that point, had never won an Olympic gold medal, despite being the fastest man in the world for several years. So I don't really think that Marty's story is too plausible. And the evidence that I found to suggest otherwise, which curiously has been buried for a long time, was that Jesse spent pretty much all week campaigning to be on the 4x100-meter relay team. Newspaper reports, he said things to the effect of, you know, "Boy, I'm just getting the feel of this place. I'd really like to run in that relay. I hope Coach finds a spot for me." And all of that has been kind of forgotten in the building of the Jesse Owens legend over the years. And I want to make it clear, I don't begrudge him that at all. He had every right to want to compete on the 4x100-meter relay team. He was the fastest man in the world. He was the best in the world at what he did. Today, it wouldn't be an issue. In no subsequent Olympics has the American who won the gold medal in the individual event not run in the relay. Up to that point in time, it had been kind of a 50-50 proposition. Americans had been so dominant in the relays that to get as many of the boys, as they said in those days, medals, they would put the guys who were not the best on the relay because they were still good enough to beat everybody else. And again, it's not to begrudge Jesse, but to me it was very interesting that this is a part of the story that had been so so long forgotten and misrepresented by people who were involved. And I think not only did Jesse have every right to be in that competition because he was the best in the world, but he really had grown to dislike the German press, I should put it, which had famously called he and Ralph Metcalf and Cornelius Johnson, Dave Allbritton, and Archie Williams, and John Woodruff, who were all American, African-Americans who won gold medals at those games, as America's black auxiliaries, suggesting that they were not, in fact, full-fledged Americans, and in an effort to diminish the American achievement. So the thing that's strange, though, is that the coaches who said they were doing this because they want to put the best team out on the field had not done so in the 4x400-meter competition. In fact, the 4x400-meter presents an entirely different story. Two Americans won the gold and the bronze, Archie Williams and Jimmy Louval. They finished 1-3. Two Englishmen finished 2-4. And yet in the 4x400-meter relay, the two black Americans, Williams and Louval, were not put on the team, and the U.S. lost by a full 2 seconds to the Brits. So there's an inconsistency there. I'm hoping that you'll have some questions. Before I finish, though, I had mentioned the boycott debate, and to me that's one of the fascinating things about the story because of the untenable position put so many of the prominent African-American athletes in. They were being asked by a large segment of the African-American population in the country not to go to the games. In fact, Walter White, who was the head of the NAACP at the time, wrote an impassioned letter to Jesse urging him to reconsider his position against the boycott because, in his words, bigotry anywhere is something that we cannot tolerate. We should not be going to Germany. We should not be in any way giving the appearance that we condone what the Third Reich stands for or any of its policies. The Nuremberg Laws had just been passed the previous fall, stripping Jews of even their most basic citizenship and rights and privileges. And yet, when you think of that argument from Jesse Owens's perspective, here is a guy who cannot eat in many restaurants in the United States, cannot check into most of the fancy hotels in the country, who cannot play, if he were so inclined or talented enough, in the National Football League or the NBA. Oh, there was no NBA, but there was pro basketball, or the major leagues. And he's being asked by a lot of white Americans and some prominent black Americans not to go to Germany because of the way they're treating their minuscule Jewish minority. Now, you could argue either way. There were, in fact, some athletes who took a stand against going to Germany, but the most prominent of them was Walter Nugass, who was a Jewish sprinter from Tulane University. And obviously, there's a different dynamic at work for a Jewish athlete going to Germany, but it didn't stop Marty Glickman, and it didn't stop Sam Stoller from going. And so it's just amazing to me to think of the gall of some people to even suggest to Jesse Owens that he should not have this one opportunity, the one opportunity that he would have ever had, because, of course, there were no Olympics in 1940 or 1944, to create this legend, to prove to the world how magnificent an athlete he was, to protest German bigotry when he was living in the world that he was living in. One last thing I want to say before I want to take some questions, how much the world has changed and how powerless the athletes were at the time, particularly the black athletes. One thing about Owens' story that's been also utterly forgotten, after he wins the fourth gold medal, he's immediately hustled onto a train for Cologne, a few hundred miles away, to compete in an exhibition event with several of his American track and field teammates. These exhibition events had been set up by the American Olympic Committee, as it was called at the time, basically to pay for the entire expenses of the entire Olympic voyage over there. And so there were events in Czechoslovakia, two in Germany, one in England, one in Stockholm. And Jesse Owens and his teammates were expected to go to all of these events, not get a dime for any of it, to leave the Olympic Games before they had concluded, a full week before they had concluded, so that they could fill the coffers of the American Olympic Committee. So Jesse obliges. He goes to Cologne. He flies to Czechoslovakia. They're not even giving him food money. He's bumming sandwiches off of passengers sitting next to him. And finally, he goes back to Germany from Czechoslovakia. Then they fly him to London for an exhibition I think it's called White Stadium. And all this time, he's getting flooded with offers from Hollywood, from Broadway. Come out here, spend 6 weeks with Eddie Cantor, and you'll make $10,000. Bill Bojangles Robinson was offering him thousands of dollars to do a show on Broadway. And these, you know, this is a guy who's never seen more than, $50 in his pocket at any time. And he's saying, I better get back there. You know, this is crazy. So he refuses to go on the last leg of this barnstorming tour to Stockholm, Sweden. And he makes his refusal. It happens to come on the final day of the Olympics in Germany on August 13th. 13th. So Jesse Owens, who's just won 4 gold medals, who has represented the United States so honorably in the face of fascism and Nazism, who has made this statement, which is probably unrivaled in the history of athletics for equality, for the indomitability of the human spirit, all that stuff. On the final day of the Olympics, Avery Brundage, the notorious head of the American Olympic Committee, who would eventually become the head of the International Olympic Committee, expels Jesse Owens from amateur sports for refusing to go to Stockholm for the final, God bless you, on the final leg of the barnstorming tour. So can you imagine a world in which Jesse Owens, particularly as a black athlete, is so powerless that for refusing to go on the sixth and final stop of this barnstorming tour during the Olympics, he is officially made ineligible and kicked out of the Olympic movement on the last day of the Games and never reinstated. That was the end of his amateur career. So I understand, you know, what Jesse Owens did and why Jesse Owens did the things later in life that I think he thought he had to do. And much of that had to do with exaggerating the story of how Adolf Hitler snubbed him, which is the one thing, if there's any one thing, we kind of all remember about that. So if there are any questions about Jesse Owens, about those games, please. Yes, sir.
It was my understanding that Avery Brundage, who was a world-class anti-Semite, is the one that directed the track coaches not to run Stolman.
That's been a theory for a long time. Avery Brundage, who, as I said, would become the head of the International Olympic Committee after the Second World War, he is in many ways a very impressive figure. He's an entirely self-made multimillionaire. He was an outstanding athlete. At the University of Illinois. He is undoubtedly, though, an anti-Semite, a bigot, a Germanophile. And if not for all of those qualities, Jesse Owens never would have become a gold medalist, because it was only because of Avery Brundage's cunning and political savvy that the boycott movement was defeated. But as to your point about expelling Stoller and Glickman, Glickman always said that he thought Avery Brundage was behind it, that he did not want to embarrass Adolf Hitler by putting two Jews up on the gold medal stand at his own games. That's very plausible, but there's never been any evidence that supports that. Before Marty died, he said that there was a letter somewhere, you know, from Brundage to either Robertson or Cromwell, I don't quite remember, or something like that, or to Goebbels, actually, that said, you know, see, I helped you out, something like that, but nobody's ever found that letter. And Sam Stoller, on the other hand, the other Jewish runner who didn't make the team, he always felt that he was not a victim of anti-Semitism. At worst, well, at best, I guess it would be, it was latent anti-Semitism. All that Dean Cromwell was doing, he thought, was protecting two USC runners because, you know, Dean, if Foy Draper and Frank Wyckoff win the gold medal, basically the coach wins the gold medal. That's on it. And in fact, I should have said that's what happened. Not only did they win, they set a world record that stood for 20-plus years. The Germans got disqualified, and the Dutch didn't even come close. It was the biggest rout in the history of the event. So the whole thing about the Germans and the Dutch having those secret runners was farcical. Yes?
I think you've already said that apparently Hitler's snub at Jesse Owens, I assume, therefore never shaking his hand. Did he ever comment?
Well, I probably should have gone to it earlier. It's a long... Do we have time for this? How much time do we have? Okay. The Hitler snub story, this is what happens, okay? On the first day of the track and field competition, Cornelius Johnson wins the gold medal in the high jump. He is an African-American. Hitler leaves the stadium shortly before the event is decided. Some people take this immediately as a snub, as an intentional effort not to have to congratulate or shake the hands of an African-American. It's possible. It's quite possible, but... It was getting very late. It had started to rain. The Germans said, no, we didn't want to offend anybody. You got the wrong idea. Hitler was on a very strict schedule. There was traffic going back to the city. He had to beat it back. Really, that's what they said. And so if anybody had, but it became a big story that night that Hitler had snubbed Cornelius Johnson after publicly congratulating two German gold medal winners that day in his box. Tilly Fleischer and Hans Volke. And so that night, the head of the International Olympic Committee, Count Henri de Baillet-Latour, a Belgian physician. The current head of the IOC is a Belgian physician, Jacques Roga. He said, look, you can't do this. You're only here as a ceremonial host. You've got no official role in these games. This is absolutely unacceptable. You either congratulate everyone or you congratulate no one. So by the time Jesse Owens wins his first gold medal the next day, Hitler really has been chastened. He doesn't want to make any enemies. He doesn't want to start any controversies. And he actually says, okay, I won't congratulate anyone publicly, even the German gold medal winners. So Jesse Owens is never congratulated publicly by Hitler. Owens, for his part, went to great lengths to say, I didn't feel snubbed. I think he waved at me once. I think some people thought they saw the wave, et cetera, et cetera. But it became a big story. But for his part, Owens kept saying, he didn't snub me. I don't know why all of you people are picking on poor Chancellor Hitler. And in fact, in the fall of 19—you got to understand, you know, it's 1936. It's not 1945. There's a very different perspective about who Adolf Hitler is at this point, especially, you know, a 22-year-old guy who's never been to Germany. And he campaigns for Alf Landon in the fall of 1936 against Franklin Roosevelt and says on the stump, it wasn't Hitler who snubbed me, it was Franklin Roosevelt, who in fact never did congratulate him. So that's a very... condensed version of the story. That's it? Okay. Thank you.